In a world drowning in confusion and false teaching, faithful voices have never been more critical. For 35 years, Sola Media has stood as that voice, helping Christians to know what you believe and why you believe it. But we're not just looking back. We're looking ahead to the millions who still need to hear the gospel proclaimed clearly and defended boldly. Will you join us in this critical work? Your generous support will help us expand our apologetics content to reach seekers and strengthen believers, enhance our digital platforms to engage younger generations where they are, and strengthen partnerships that multiply our gospel impact to fuel another 35 years of reformation in hearts, homes, and churches. Visit solamedia.org/reformation and give today.
A lot of people say Tolkien really disliked Narnia, which I think is what you're getting at. He liked it. Mm-hmm. He disliked it for the amount of mythology that was being combined in a story that didn't really have a straightforward history, a straightforward plot. Because if you read Lord of the Rings, he has footnotes, for goodness sake, about everything and the history of everything. And then another thing, it's really nuanced because Tolkien read Narnia before Aslan was part of the story. Mm. And he was really concerned about the fawn narrative, because in mythology, fawns are quite unsavory characters.
Interesting.
And so he got to the part where they're examining the fawn's bookshelf. Lucy's looking at the bookshelf and it says, "The Love Life of Fawns." And Tolkien, I imagine, snapped the book shut and was like, "None of that." And so that's the nub of the falling out. I wouldn't necessarily call it a falling out, but a disagreement that I think got blown a bit out of proportion.
Huh.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Applying the riches of the Reformation to the modern church. This is White Horse Sin, a weekly roundtable discussion about theology and culture.
Hello and welcome to White Horse Inn. Merry Christmas, everybody. We're beginning a new series on the theology of C.S. Lewis. How does a once atheist Oxford Don become the storyteller who gave us Aslan? And how did that conversion shape what he wrote? How did C.S. Lewis begin writing the famous Chronicles of Narnia? In this episode, we're looking at how Lewis develops a theology in the Chronicles of Narnia around core doctrines: creation, sin, atonement, Christology, and the new heavens and new earth. And to have this conversation are Mike Horton, Bob Hiller, and Walter Strickland. But we have a special guest, my daughter, Sophia Holcomb, and I am so thrilled to introduce her. Just as a proud dad and thrilled to have this conversation with her. Sophia is an 11th grader at the Geneva School. She's interested in classics, which includes Greek and Roman language and history. She's joining us because the next two episodes are on C.S. Lewis, and she is my go-to Lewis scholar. And I'm not saying that as dad exaggeration. Regularly for years, I'll go out and grab a cigar and a bourbon, and she'll come out and we'll just start talking about which one of the books C.S. Lewis is reading and everything she's learning, and then the books about C.S. Lewis. She has read all of Lewis's works except for some of the technical literary criticism works, such as Allegory of Love, Preface to Paradise Lost, The Discarded Image, Spencer's Images of Life, and the English literature in the 16th century, excluding drama. At her high school, she's taken three courses on the life and works of C.S. Lewis. In the summer of 2024, she studied at Wheaton College and took a college course during the summer called Philosophy and Imagination in the Works of C.S. Lewis. She last summer was awarded the William George Schuster Research Grant for Young Scholars, and that granted her a chance to spend a week with me at the Wade Center at Wheaton College so she could continue her research on Joy Davidman, C.S. Lewis's wife, and her journey from atheism and communism to Christianity. She's presented a few papers at C.S. Lewis conferences. 2 years ago, it was The Four Loves Reflected in the Chronicles of Narnia. And most recently, it was Lewis's use of literature to respond to personal tragedies in his life. You can check her out on her Substack. But Sophia, thank you for joining us. I'm so proud of you. And I'm glad that my White Horse Inn friends get to meet you, mm-hmm. and that the listeners get to learn from you. So instead of listening to me cry out of pride for you, let me ask you a question just to kind of get us started to teach us about C.S. Lewis. Who is C.S. Lewis? And please start with the basics. Don't assume anything.
Okay. So C.S. Lewis, Clive Staples Lewis, was known as Jack to his friends and family. He was born in Belfast, Ireland in 1898. And a lesser known fact about him is that he fought in World War I and was wounded. And he carried shrapnel in his body till the day of his death. And so today, he's known as one of the greatest lay theologians of the 20th century. And I would like to emphasize the word lay in that title. He wasn't a professional or trained theologian. He was actually a medievalist by trade. He was an English literature tutor and professor. And he wrote some of the work that is still definitive in this field today. He wrote The Allegory of Love and Oxford English History of English Literature in the 16th century, excluding drama. And in many universities, that's still the go-to. So, but despite being the definitive author for works like that, he's most well known for his children's novels and his book, Mere Christianity. He also wrote over 30 books, along with poetry, letters, and multiple volumes, and a lot of essays that were published posthumously. Regarding his career, he was a tutor at Magdalen College, Oxford, from about 1925 to 1954. And in 1954, he finally achieved a professorship at Cambridge. He was denied a professorship three times at Oxford because of his popular Christian writing, because that was not the fashion for an Oxford don to publish outside of his field and also to publish at the popular level. And so at Cambridge, he held the chair made specifically for him called the Chair of Medieval and Renaissance Literature until his retirement. He was very close friends with J.R.R. Tolkien, another very well-known author. And with Tolkien, he was a member of a literary circle in Oxford called the Inklings. And their goal was to integrate faith and imagination into writing literature, the kind of literature they wanted to read. A ministry that he had that kind of fell upon him, he didn't really seek this out, was that when he became famous specifically in America, his fans started writing him letters, and he would receive hundreds of letters a year. But what's interesting is he replied to every single one of them. And one of these letters he received was from an American writer named Joy Davidman. And he would later eventually marry Joy. And they were married for 3 years before her death in 1960 of cancer. But while they were married and before they were married, they collaborated on some of his later works, specifically Till We Have Faces. After the Inklings had ended, it was a personal inkling, which is a really fantastic story that I would encourage listeners to go learn about and research. And so when she died in 1960, he was left with two stepsons that he raised on his own. And then Lewis died in Oxford, England, just shy of his 65th birthday on November 22nd, 1963, which interestingly is the same day JFK and Aldous Huxley died. And there's a fantastic book by Peter Kreft called Between Heaven and Hell that is a dialogue between those three men and their various religious viewpoints that I would also encourage listeners to check out. It's a really interesting book.
Thank you for the intro on C.S. Lewis and his life. Can you tell us about his conversion to Christianity?
Yeah, so Lewis, like I said, was born in Belfast, but he was born into a Christian family. And his grandfather was a priest and rector of a church in the Church of Ireland, connected to the Church of England. But he had these experiences that began in childhood and lasted his entire life that would always kind of battle with his materialist and atheistic worldview. He called it joy, but it was these longings for the supernatural or experiences of beauty that he could not explain empirically or scientifically that seemed to point to something beyond the material reality. And this would bother him when he was an atheist because he just couldn't explain it. And Lewis was someone that really liked to have an explanation for everything. He prided himself on being a genius with a photographic memory. And so he had these experiences of beauty, aesthetic experiences. But the first strike against God was when his mother died when Lewis was 9 years old. She died of cancer rather quickly in a matter of weeks. And a matter of weeks after her death, Lewis was sent to boarding school. His father sent him away because his father didn't know how to deal with two sons in the midst of grief. And so Lewis was sent to these honestly pretty terrible boarding schools. And he didn't see any faith, real faith, portrayed in these schools. So it was easy to step away And he began to view the world as cruel and meaningless. And so he turned to a materialist view of the world, with reason being the highest form of knowledge. But along with that, he had this flirtation with the occult and interest in the supernatural, because he had these experiences of longing and he thought, maybe this is the avenue for that. But he quickly came away from that after having several friends have bad psychological experiences connected with the occult. So even though Lewis didn't really want to believe in the supernatural, he also didn't want to experience any of that. So he gave it all up in favor of what he called the new look. And this was a mindset he adopted at university when he was at Oxford, which was a strict materialist and atheistic sensibility. None of this aesthetic apologetics, none of this beauty, he wasn't going to bother with any of it. But then God invaded that worldview with authors like George MacDonald and G.K. Chesterton. Of George MacDonald, he said his books baptized his imagination, although the rest of him took a little bit longer. And G.K. Chesterton, he loved G.K. Chesterton's reasoning in spite of him being a Christian. He thought his arguments were, he was good at arguing, he had good logic, but he had this quirk of being a Christian. And he began to notice that a lot of these authors he really liked had this annoying quirk and oddity of being a Christian. And he also began to think of books by authors that were atheists or non-Christians as being thin and tinny and fluff. And so he said, I'll read the quote because I think this, he puts it perfectly. He said, a young man who wishes to remain a sound atheist cannot be too careful of his reading. So one of the things God used to get him on his side was his books. And another tactic God used was his friendships. And in about 1926, he became friends with Tolkien, who had the same odd quirk of being a reasonable Christian, a smart Christian, which was an oxymoron to Lewis at the time. And also around this time, one of the most hard-bitten atheists that Lewis knew admitted to Lewis that there was good evidence for the Gospels, that Jesus was who he said he was.
Oh, interesting.
And Lewis was shaken by this. He was also shaken by the books he was reading. He was shaken by these smart Christians he was finding himself around. And so all of these factors converged upon him. And he was still experiencing these longings and experiences of beauty that science could not explain. He refused to believe that his most profound thoughts were just atoms colliding in his skull. And so essentially all of this ganged up on him. And another quote by him, he puts it into words better than I can. He said, quote, that which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. I finally gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed. Perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England.
That's great.
That's such a good quote.
Yeah. And this happened about 1929, 1930. But this was just a conversion to theism. He reluctantly, as he said, believed that God existed, but he wouldn't call him God. He would call him either absolute or spirit because that was safer. So you can really see this come back around in Chronicles of Narnia. He's not safe, but he's good. Lewis experienced that himself. So about a year later was when his conversion to Christianity took place. He was taking a walk with his friends, Tolkien and Hugo Dyson, both Christians, both eventual Inklings. And one of the things they were discussing was mythology. And it came around to how discussing how much Lewis loved the myths of dying and rising gods in every culture. He found it mysteriously moving, as he said. And Tolkien suggested that perhaps there was one true myth where a god died, came back to life, and thus doing so saved his people. And so this was called the true myth. And this planted a seed in Lewis's mind that came to fruition about 8 days later, on September 28th, 1931. Lewis was going to the zoo with his brother on his brother's motorcycle. Lewis was in his sidecar and they were going to Whipsnade Zoo. And again, I'll read the quote because it's just fantastic. So quote, when we set out, I did not believe that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. But when we reached the zoo, I did. I had not exactly spent the journey in thought nor in great emotion. Emotional is perhaps the last word we can apply in some of the most important events. It was more like when a man, after a long sleep, still lying motionless on the bed, becomes aware that he is now awake.
Wow.
That's good. So
what
good.
A great description of the new birth. Wow.
Right.
So now we have C.S. Lewis, a Christian, an mm-hmm. Oxford Don, a medieval specialist, medieval literature. How did he go to writing children's books, children's literature, like the Chronicles mm-hmm. of Narnia, which we're going to discuss for the rest of this episode?
Yeah, so the way Lewis came up with fiction specifically was he wouldn't have a coherent plot in the beginning. He would get an image in his mind. He would call it like bubbling up. And one of the images he had was in 1939 of a fawn walking through the snow carrying parcels. And he had this idea, but he put it in a drawer and set it away. But then partially inspired by the children who were staying at the kilns during the evacuation of London during the Blitz in 1945 to 1949, he was inspired by them, wanted to entertain them in some way. So he started writing The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. He wrote it fairly quickly from 1949 to 1950 when it was published. And then the rest followed in quick succession until the seventh book came out in 1956. And a really important thing in a lot of the dialogue surrounding Chronicles of Narnia is that it's not an allegory. A lot of people refer to it as an allegory, and it's tempting to, because Aslan is Jesus, Edmund is Judas, as some say, the redemption plot, very much like the Christian narrative. But Lewis made it very clear that he wrote it as an imaginative supposal, which he would do in some of his later fiction or other fiction as well. And by that, he meant that he imagined, what would Christianity be like if it were in Narnia? He created the world beforehand and then thought, what would Jesus be like if he were in this world? Well, we have talking animals. I suppose he'd be a lion. So Aslan kind of bounded in out of nowhere, as Lewis would say. So it was kind of a unexpected event combined with World War II, as a lot of his writing was inspired by World War II, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah. Sophia, can I ask, we often hear the story of Tolkien and Lewis having a bit of a falling out over mm-hmm. whether Lewis was too allegorical, whether he mm-hmm. was is that true? And what was the nub of their disagreement if they had it?
Mm-hmm. So along with that, a lot of people say Tolkien really disliked Narnia, which I think is what you're getting at. He liked it. Mm-hmm. He disliked it for the amount of mythology that was being combined in a story that didn't really have a straightforward history, a straightforward plot. Because if you read Lord of the Rings, he has footnotes, for goodness sake, about everything and the history of everything. And then another thing, it's really nuanced, because Tolkien read Narnia before Aslan was part of the story. And he was really concerned about the fawn narrative, because in mythology, fawns are quite unsavory mm-hmm. characters.
Interesting.
And he got to the part where they're examining the fawn's bookshelf. Lucy's looking at the bookshelf and it says, "The Love Life of Fawns." And Tolkien, I imagine, snapped the book shut and was like, "None of that." And so that's the nub of the falling out. I wouldn't necessarily call it a falling out, but a disagreement that I think got blown a bit out of proportion.
Huh.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Isn't it? Yeah.
So just real quick before we jump into some of the theology, there's some debate mm-hmm. as well about the order of the books and how you should
read
them. Very mm-hmm. curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. And why is the right answer to start with Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe?
question. Yes. Well, Lewis wrote a letter to he had a lot of correspondence with children writing fan mail about Narnia. And in one, he suggested to start with The Magician's Nephew. But I would remind listeners, he's speaking to a young child. And if you start with Magician's Nephew, you get a coherent history of Narnia. But I think the way Lewis intended it, he wrote Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe first. And when he talks about Aslan showing up, he says, "Now, you know just as much as these children about Aslan, which is nothing." And I think that adds to the experience of finding out who Aslan is, because he describes how each of the children responded. And you miss out on so much beauty if you already know the creation story of Narnia.
Yep.
So I would encourage people to start with Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Awesome. I appreciate
that. That's the right answer. Right answer.
The five solas of the Reformation brought essential truths of salvation and purpose into clear focus. These truths are just as critical to Christian life today as they were 500 years ago. Rediscover their meaning and relevance in our newest booklet, The Five Solas, Essential Truths for a Modern Reformation. Inside, you'll explore each of the five solas: grace alone, faith alone, Christ alone, scripture alone, and God's glory alone, and why they still matter today. Support our work with a gift of any amount, and we'll send you a copy. Visit solamedia.org/offers to get yours today.
So we're going to dive in, guys, on this exploring of the theological contours of Narnia. So let's start with creation. And Sophia, just because you started off doesn't mean you can't dive on in. So jump in anytime you want on the rest of this. But we'll start where, you know, the Bible starts, with God and creation.
Yeah, I'd be interested, Sophia, in your unpacking a little bit. God being not safe but good, Aslan being not safe but good. That runs throughout. I think of Jill at the stream, creeping toward the stream to get water, and there Aslan shows up, and she's terrified and says, "Do you eat little girls?" And she says, "Oh, I've eaten empires," and da-da-da-da-da. Then I shan't come to the river. He says, "You must come to the river. You must drink or you will die." And you get these pictures of not safe, but good. Unpack that a little.
Yeah, I think Lewis was big on humans' relationship to God and the power that humans have in that relationship, which is interesting.
Yeah.
It's slightly Arminian, just slightly. but he was really, so he examined this in his later fiction. I find it helpful to think about if we're all camping, and there's a fire that we're sitting around. The fire is good. We could almost say the fire loves us. It's providing heat. It's cooking our food. But then say, I don't know, my dad sticks his head in the fire. He changed his relationship.
Which I've seen him do.
That's why I picked him, yeah. So, yeah, that would be changing your relationship to the fire. The fire provides these good things, but then it's also quite dangerous when you change your relationship to it. Mm-hmm. So Lewis was big on the response you have to God's pursuit of you. It's either the hound of heaven or it's this cat stalking a mouse. It's probably not great to compare God to a hungry cat, but so I think that's the best way to think about it, is that Lewis was examining how do humans respond to God's pursuit. Mm. And yeah.
Interesting.
You also go back to the introduction of with Mrs. Beaver, Mr. Beaver, you know, he's the king of the wood. He's the king of everything. Of course, he's not safe. He's good.
Right.
This is the attributes of God. God is loving and holy, and it's not one or the other. God is both, and that's the kind of beautiful piece you see in this not safe but good. I love starting with that for a lot of sermons, because it's just you can go in so many directions, but it just it makes it like he loves you, but he's holy. That's the problem.
You can't control him.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So when you read the Chronicles, like every book has, at least for me, every book has particular instances or images that just kind of haunt you in like the best possible way. And one of them is in The Magician's Nephew, and we do begin with the creation of Narnia. Let's talk a little bit about like Aslan sings creation into existence, which I get choked up just thinking about that, that creation is a beautiful song. What is it? One of the humans who comes in to that scene says, "If I'd heard a song like that when I was a younger man, I would have been a better person," or something along these lines. Like there's something glorious about this song that brings creation to existence. What's the significance of that?
Well, can I read before Sophia jumps in? Here's what, this is from The Magician's Nephew. "In the darkness, something was happening at last. A voice had begun to sing, the most beautiful noise he had ever heard. It was so beautiful he could hardly bear it. Then two wonders happened at the same moment. One was that the voice was suddenly joined by other voices, more voices than you could possibly count. They were in harmony with it, but far higher up the scale, cold, tingling, silvery voices. The second wonder was that the blackness overhead all at once was blazing with stars. They didn't come out gently one by one as they do on a summer evening. One moment, there had been nothing but darkness. Next moment, a thousands of points of light leaping out. If you'd seen and heard it, you would have felt quite certain that it was the stars themselves which were singing. and that it was the first voice, the deep one, which had made them appear and made them sing.
Mm.
The voice on the earth was now louder and more triumphant, but the voices in the sky, after singing loudly with it for a time, began to get fainter. All the time the voice went on singing, the eastern sky changed from white to pink and from pink to gold. The voice rose and rose till all the air was shaking with it. And just as it swelled to the mightiest and most glorious sound it had yet produced, the sun arose. The earth was of many colors. They were fresh, hot, and vivid. They made you feel excited until you saw the singer himself, and then you forgot everything else.
Mm.
It was a lion. Huge, shaggy, and bright, it stood facing the risen sun. Its mouth was wide open in song, and it was about 300 yards away. And as he walked and sang, the valley grew green with grass. It spread out from the lion like a pool. It ran up the sides of the little hills like a wave. Soon, there were other things besides grass. The slopes grew dark with heather, and when he burst into a rapid series of lighter notes, she was not surprised to see primroses suddenly appearing in every direction. But now the song had once more changed. It was more like what we would call a tune, but it was also far wilder. It made you want to run and jump and climb. Showers of birds came out of the trees. Butterflies fluttered. Bees got to work on the flowers as if they hadn't a second to lose. And now you could hardly hear the song of the lion. There was so much cawing, cooing, crowing, braying, neighing, baying, barking, lowing, bleating, and trumpeting. Then there came a swift flash like a fire, but it burnt nobody, either from the sky or from the lion itself. And every drop of blood tingled in the children's bodies.
Hmm.
And the deepest, wildest voice they had ever heard was saying, "Narnia, Narnia, Narnia, awake, love, think, speak, be walking trees, be talking beasts, be divine waters."
Hmm. It's just, it's like that scene with all the animals braying and neighing, and then the lion, you see the lion. It's like the Lion King with better theology. Right?
Yeah.
It's this beautiful scene. Like everything is cohesive. Everything's working together, coming around the one lion who's singing it all into existence.
Mm-hmm.
I love the line too, where he says, you would think that the stars were singing. Like he does this interesting thing throughout the books where he almost like gives a nod to paganism and saying like, because Lewis will talk this way, that there's hints of truth in everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like you can almost see why the pagans would worship the stars and the sun, because they're these glorious things until you see the one who sings them into existence. And then mm-hmm. they pale in comparison mm-hmm. to the one who actually gave them life. And so this sort of overwhelming nature of the gospel and of the true king in the face of all of this doesn't mm-hmm. diminish its beauty, but actually exemplifies the beauty of everything because of the glory of the lion, mm-hmm. the glory of the true mm-hmm. king. I think it's mm-hmm. just wonderful.
So is there something to be said about the fact that Aslan did create through song? Is there something mm-hmm. to be said about his theology and relationship to beauty and order and divine yeah. speech and those sorts of things, Sophia?
Yeah, I think so. I think, so when Lewis talked about his experiences of joy, he would say it's like the scent of a flower we have not found, news from a country we have not visited, and like a song we have not heard yet. Hmm. And so I think this is the fruition of that song we have not heard yet. And going back, I'm glad that you mentioned paganism, because I was thinking as you were reading that, how Lewis was deeply familiar with mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of myths, the gods create humans for a purpose, to serve them. It's all pointing back to the gods. They're not gifting the humans anything. The humans are a gift to the gods. But in this story, where Aslan's singing, he's giving things to his subjects, the other animals.
Yeah, that's great.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. I don't think that was mm-hmm. a mistake.
Yeah, that's really insightful.
Creation ex nihilo. I mean, this did not exist. He's not forming something.
Right.
He's creating something out of nothing. Mm. And it's his word, his creative word that is creating this, which is spectacular. Mm-hmm. It mirrors quite well.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, the idea of singing the world into existence doesn't seem far from the Psalms.
Mm-mm.
It doesn't mention the heavens are singing the glory of God. They're telling the glory of God. But you can imagine it being sort of like a call and response. You know, God is calling things into existence, and then they're responding according to what he has called them in existence to be. He called dogs to come into existence, and they started barking.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's so many theological topics, and what hangs out here is the original goodness of creation, which is something we talk about quite a bit, that we don't start with depravity. We start with the original God. We start with God, who created everything good. But something happened. Evil and sin intrudes and is addressed. And Sophia, if you could, I remember talking with you a while ago about how the witch is viewed. So can you talk about quickly that kind of curse and the witch, and then guys jump in on original sin or consequences of sin and the intrusion of sin into this good world of Narnia?
Mm-hmm. So an important thing about Narnia is that it's not dualistic in the slightest. It's not good and evil are on the same playing field. Hmm. The witch, the white witch, Jadis, in The Lion, Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, cast a spell over Narnia that gives 100 years winter, never Christmas. But the whole time, she seems super powerful to the children and scary, but she's deathly afraid of Aslan. And she seems silly in her parody of what a queen is. And so she tempts one of the children, Edmund, that she'll give him all the riches. He'll be a prince alongside her if he betrays his siblings. And so he does. And the punishment for this Narnian law is the punishment for a traitor is death. But then Aslan talks about a deeper magic from before the dawn of time. And I've always read that deeper magic as the proto-evangel. And it kind of comes through in The Magician's Nephew when he promises to Diggory that, yes, there's wrong in this world of Narnia, but I will make it right. So Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is the gospel narrative of the Chronicles of Narnia because Aslan promises to forgive Edmund, but not just forgive Edmund, to redeem all of Narnia, thus ending this witch's rule. And he does it quite easily, which is what I love about it. It's not good. Like it took Aslan that much effort to, I mean, yes, he died. I'm not saying Jesus didn't take effort to save us, but relative, like he didn't have to fight a battle or a very long battle. That is, he died and rose again, and the witch was defeated like that.
Yeah. There's that great scene in The Magician's Nephew where Jadis first sees Aslan and she's like freaked out, and somehow a lamppost, as it turns out, has come into the creation. And she like shucks the lamppost at Aslan and it just kind of bounces off of him. Like it does nothing to him.
Right.
Like she had no chance against him from the beginning.
Going back real quick to the point you made about the White Witch, about how she was kind of seen as goofy and not taken seriously because of kind of going back to your dualism point, that they're not, it's not like Aslan and Jadis and somehow their eternal powers fighting against each other, but there's almost the way she's portrayed. Can you say more about that real quick, Sophia?
Yeah, yeah. She has a chariot driven by these non-talking animals, these wolves. She has gnomes that come to her aid and magic wand. So it's the stereotypical witch that Lewis is appealing to. It's not like he was very creative in coming up with her. She has this crown of ice. She sits on a ice throne. It's all very one-to-one. Like she's the ice queen. She's icy. She's not a very complex character. We don't really get her backstory that much. So I think it's almost comical in a very subtle way, because I think Lewis is not even paying much mind to her at all. It's that she's there and she's causing trouble, but Aslan's got it. He's got it under control.
That's what it was. It was the comical nature that plays into the dualism, kind of almost the dismissive way.
Yeah.
Like, I will die. It's going to be costly, but this is not a fair battle.
Well, also Edmund. So, it's not just the sort of devil figure. It's also the Adam figure in the garden. It's pitiful. It's not that he acts out of courage. He acts out of weakness, not out of strength. He has everything that he needs. He is a prince of Narnia. And he nevertheless turns all of that over for some ridiculous fake promise from someone who thinks that she rules the kingdom. We're silly. It's not that we're smart and clever and strong and powerful. But when we turn away from God, we're just dumb.
It's kind of like getting mad at the Israelites when you read Exodus for not listening to God or making idols, but then it's also very relatable in the same way. So.
Except for this, have any of you ever actually tried Turkish Delight?
Yes.
It is nasty.
You like it?
I used to hate it, and then you have to try not the rose flavor, the orange flavor is quite good.
The orange flavor Turkish Delight. You would sell out your family for orange flavor Turkish Delight.
I would tolerate it. I would not sell out anybody for it, though.
Tolerate it. There you go.
That's funny.
I was very underwhelmed myself.
I want to hear from you guys. Anything from you guys on either sin, evil, or the redemption atonement? Because, I mean, that's a huge piece that Sophia alluded to and mentioned, which is that dying in Edmund's place. It's a substitution right there. Which is interesting because that's not his go-to, which Sophia can talk about if she wants to, or you guys can talk about. But let's talk about that.
It presupposes a curse.
Yeah.
I mean, there is the law of Narnia that can't be bent. It can't be changed. But there is a deeper magic, you know, which presumably is the mercy of God greater than all our sin.
And this idea, I mean, Sophia, I mean, I know you said it, but always winter, never Christmas. You know, there's a possibility of camping out there for a while and just talking about the fact that there's the curse, but there's no reprieve. There's no gem in that curse, which would be Christmas. You know, the winter, but never having any warmth or any redemption in that. And so that Christmas represents in many ways. It just seems that right there is just sort of sets the table for that, you know, and I'll say it in scare quotes because of what you said, Justin, about Lewis, that substitutionary sort of reality that we look ahead to. So that right there has a lot packed into it that helps us to anticipate some sort of redemption of some sort.
People get really irritated. They'll say, oh, this is kind of this Anselmian view, and I'm not sure I can totally explicate that perfectly, but the sort of penal substitutionary atonement where someone dies for the sake of someone else and someone takes a punishment for someone else. And theologians will argue over whether that's an accurate view within the scriptures. It is, but it's conversation for another time. but they'll get really upset that people say, well, Lewis's view of the atonement here is just so, like, it's only for one person and it's not for everybody. And it's just this substitutionary stuff. So old and unnecessary. And to that, I just want to say, shut up. Enjoy a good book. Like, one, it is great theology. And two, it is this great scene when those mice come and start chewing at the ropes. And you're just like, the girls are weeping because you got the women basically at the tomb. I mean, it's just fantastic. And I agree with you, Sophia. Like, let's not go one-to-one allegory. But when you start to see the beauty of a powerful and all-powerful being willing to sacrifice for the sake of someone who's guilty, you're starting to smell the gospel, and it is just wonderful.
And there's a distinction between the deeper magic and the deeper magic still, also, which is, deeper magic is justice. Deeper magic still is grace and resurrection. And so that's pretty important for us to see.
Good point.
All right, we have a few more minutes. Let's talk about sanctification a little bit, because there's some other books, Prince Caspian, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, Silver Chair. There's some examples of that. What do you guys want to talk about there?
The great scene from The Voyage of the Dawn Treader is Eustace becoming a dragon. That scene where he's by the water, and I think Lewis does a great job multiple times with this water imagery. When the changes seem to take place when somebody's at the pool, at the water, it's very baptismal. But Eustace has become a dragon by sleeping in a dragon's treasure because he hadn't read his books, the right kind of books anyways. And he finds out just how awful he is until Aslan basically forces him to peel the scales off of him. And I'm not remembering it perfectly
Doesn't Aslan do it himself?
Yeah, I think he does. He says, you have to let me do it for you or something like this.
Right.
And then cuts in and it's like the most painful thing. And yet at the same time, it's completely relieving. It's
good,
a beautiful
good, but
picture
not
of sanctification.
Safe. That is not safe. Tearing off your skin is not safe, but it is good when you have dragon skin.
Yeah.
Which is a better picture of sanctification, right? It's not this sort of delightful victory walk, but it's painful dying to yourself.
Yeah.
It's painful being conformed.
I'm not doing this to hurt you. I'm doing this to save you.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Save you from your enemy. I've saved you from the guilt of your enemy and the curse of your enemy. I'm also saving you from your enemy that wants to destroy you right now.
And the enemy that you have been to me.
Yeah.
You know, from you is my enemy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sophia, what is your favorite of the Chronicles? Which one do you like the most?
I love The Last Battle the most. I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yes, it's a fantasy series, but that feels like the most realistic.
Agreed.
To me.
Yep.
I relate the most to that book. And the end is just fantastic. I mean, it's the best picture of heaven that I found anywhere in literature yet. I mean, I obviously haven't been there yet, but it's from what I read in the Bible. I think it's the closest.
On that point, Sophia, I've always, you know, wrestled with Lewis's fascination with Plato. And on the one hand, he does seem quite Platonic in terms of, so there are two different readings of Plato we don't have to go into, but one is that he actually does value the material world by seeing it as a shadow of the real world. The other reading is, well, it's just a shadow, so it isn't real. And so the trueness of the real world reduces this world to nothing but a shadow. But Lewis really seems to adjust that to a Christian perspective. Does he not? It's not like Narnia is not on clouds somewhere. Narnia is not a spiritual reality that has no materiality to it. Doesn't Narnia get redeemed?
Right. He does this in The Great Divorce as well. He emphasizes the realness of heaven and heavenly things. They're not less real, they're more real. And so I think it'd be fair, I don't want to make a definitive statement about how Lewis read Plato, but I think it would be fair to say that he read Plato as valuing the material world, not as the ultimate, like the world of the forms is a very real reality, according to Plato. And I think Lewis grabbed onto that and, like you said, adjusted it for a Christian worldview. And so he would view the world as shadowy in comparison to heaven, but Narnia is also redeemed and made more real because they go up a waterfall at the end. That wasn't how the laws of nature worked previously in Narnia. Narnia wasn't some place where you could just run without getting tired. These were things instituted by Aslan as he redeemed Narnia from the various enemies in the last battle.
So heaven and earth become one.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That would be very different from Plato.
So a perfected version of the old also. It's not a replacement of it, but a renewal of creation.
I do love right now everything that we enjoy, and it's very Augustinian, the faint music of a song we've never heard, you know, that you mentioned in a meal we haven't had. Every meal we have is kind of almost like jogging our memory of something that we know is real, we know is true. To my mind, it's a kind of good use of Platonism for Christian apologetics.
I will say this about that resurrection scene, the idea of further up and further in. I remember talking with somebody once and they were saying, heaven just seems like it's so boring. Like you just sit around all day and what do you do? Just like sing praise songs and stuff all day long. And Lewis's picture of, what did you say, Sophia? Running without getting tired. And that last scene, I mean, it's exhilarating, actually. His conception of the resurrection, the new heavens and new earth, is Lewis does for you what he himself has been feeling his whole life, like longing for that. There's something greater out there. Like, I think Lewis is tapping into something there that you get in the Bible that actually the new creation is more exhilarating than you're actually ready for. It's going to be thrilling further up and further in. And we're not even ready for what awaits us.
Well, we'll land that. We'll land here today. Lewis hoped that Narnia would refresh our imagination for the gospel that scripture proclaims. as we learn from Sophia, Aslan isn't a tame allegory. He's a signpost to the true Lion of Judah, through whom all things were made, who bore our treachery in our place, who rose so that winter would not have the final word. And that's good news before it's good advice, promise before exhortation, mercy before metrics. And when kids and grownups feel the spell of cynicism, Lewis helps us hear again that the deeper magic in Narnia points us to the good news that God's justice is fulfilled in Christ, so grace can be freely given. Sophia, thank you for setting the stage for us. Mm-hmm. That was a gift. And if today stirs your imagination and curiosity, listeners, don't turn this into a scavenger hunt for symbols. Let the stories drive you back to word and sacrament, where Christ actually gives what he promises. And again, from all of us, Merry Christmas from the White Horse Inn.
This is a production of Sola Media. This podcast is made possible by generous listeners like you. If you enjoy the show and want to help us continue this work, consider giving today at solamedia.org/donate.